Young, it's here and now. A secret investigation of abortions in Kansas is now becoming public. The Kansas State Attorney General is fighting to obtain abortion records of 90 women and girls from two abortion clinics, records that contain private medical information, including sexual activity. The clinics say the request threatens doctor-patient confidentiality, but Attorney General Phil Klein says he needs the information to determine if the women and girls were victims of sex crimes.
When a 10, 11, or 12-year-old child is pregnant, under Kansas law, that child has been raped. And as the state's chief law enforcement official, it is my obligation to investigate child rape in order to protect Kansas children.
Jody Wilgorn is covering this story for the New York Times. She joins us from the Chicago Bureau. And Jody, how long has this investigation been going on, and why are we learning about it now?
Well, Robin, we don't know exactly because it is a secret investigation and has been conducted under seal through the district court in Topeka, but it's at least about a year, it seems like. We learned about it this week because the abortion clinics, whose records are being subpoenaed, filed a brief in the state Supreme Court to block the subpoena. They don't want to produce the records, and so they're asking the state Supreme Court to intervene, and that brief was made public.
Well, we heard Attorney General Phil Klein say that the investigation is an attempt to investigate child rape, but the records he's requesting all deal with late-term abortions. What is the connection they're making?
Well, it's not entirely clear, and Mr. Klein won't discuss why he's asked for what he's asked for. The only things we know about the investigation really do come from that brief that the clinics filed. But it seems that Mr. Klein, who's a staunch opponent of abortion, has been very interested in late-term abortions for years. He was one of the authors of the Kansas law in 1998 to restrict late-term abortions, particularly when the fetus would be viable outside the womb. And it seems like this may be part of his kind of ongoing battle against those procedures.
Well, you write that the Attorney General has tried to obtain these kinds of records before. Last year, he tried to require that health workers report girls' sexual activity, citing the Kansas law that says it's illegal for anyone under 16 to have any sex, including kissing.
That's right. The health care providers sued the Attorney General and got a restraining order to block that request, but now it seems like he's getting some very similar records and maybe pursuing the similar kinds of crime.
Do prosecutors say how these records might lead them to rape suspects?
You know, they won't say specifically, but the clinics have told us that the records sometimes include very detailed information about how the girls got pregnant or how the women got pregnant, and so you can imagine that could be evidence for pursuing a rape case. As I said, though, I think many people there think that what he's really after is pursuing illegal late-term abortions or pursuing criminal charges against healthcare providers for not reporting what he calls child sexual abuse, which is any sex under 16.
And in Kansas, late-term abortions after 22 weeks can only be performed if the health of the mother is in danger.
Essentially, that's right. If the fetus is viable outside the womb, they have to do a test to see if there's viability, and then after that, the health of the mother is required as an exception.
And last year, there was a similar legal dispute on the national level when Attorney General John Ashcroft sought records of abortion providers as part of a lawsuit over the constitutionality of the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act, but that failed.
Right. I think there were three cases in which he sought those records, and one of them, a judge refused to give them records, and then I think the federal government actually withdrew the request in the other cases.
So, Jody, what is the next step in the Kansas case?
Well, the Attorney General is going to file a response to the clinic's brief with the Supreme Court. He said he would do that next week, and they could schedule oral arguments sometime this spring.
Jody Wilgorn is bureau chief for the New York Times in Chicago. Jody, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
An unusual battle over life and death is being fought at Massachusetts General Hospital here in Boston. For 2 years now, the hospital has wanted to turn off the ventilator that's keeping 80-year-old Barbara Howe alive. Howe has Lou Gehrig's disease, and she's been dependent on a breathing machine for more than 8 years. Doctors say that prolonging her life now is inhumane. But Howe's daughter, who's also her health care proxy, says her mother recognizes her, and further, her mother's wish is to be kept alive. Joining us on the line first is Dr. Michael Grodin. He's director of the Law, Medicine, and Ethics Program at Boston University Schools of Medicine and Public Health. And Dr. Grodin, this is a case where the patient has legally designated a healthcare proxy, someone to make her wishes known. The doctors disagree with the proxy. How unusual is that?
It's very, very unusual. I've been a medical ethics ethicist, if you will, for 26 years, and this comes up, you know, a handful of times. I've been involved in two or three cases where there's been an attempt to disqualify a proxy, but it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy for everyone, obviously. The hospital thinks they're doing the right thing and wants to do the best for this woman. The daughter thinks she's doing the right thing and wants to do the best for the woman. They've gone to court. Hopefully these things can be worked out without resorting to that. But it's really a difficult situation.
And as we said, Barbara Howe's daughter, Carol, has been designated as her proxy. Barbara made that decision before she lost so much function. Remind us, what is the proxy supposed to be able to do?
Right. This is called a healthcare proxy or a durable power of attorney in some states. And they have the authority to essentially make any decision that you would make if you were competent. But their job is not to do what they want, or to do what the doctors want, or do what anybody else wants, is to do what you, the patient, would have wanted.
Right, and have hopefully told them.
Right. The mother told her that she wanted to be kept alive as long as she could appreciate her family. She was diagnosed with essentially a terminal disease, but although it takes a long time, this Lou Gehrig's disease, which is where you lose muscular function, and slowly, slowly, slowly you lose function such that you can't move anything.
Mm.
And so it's hard to know at what point she would no longer appreciate her family. And the Mass General, of course, was allowing the daughter to make those decisions.
We should say the daughter says that her mother's left eye widens when she visits, and she's interpreting that as her mother, appreciating her.
Right. And so it's a judgment as to whether, in fact, she really does appreciate her family and or whether she has really moved beyond that point. And really, at this point, they're giving treatment that's harmful, that's inhumane, is what the Mass General has said, but really where she's in having more burden than she is having benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is, of course, that when she said what she would have wanted, that was while she was competent. And now it's been years down that road, and it's hard to know what she really would have wanted.
Oh, it's a terrible situation. And again, you say the hospital, many doctors have actually quit the case because they just feel it's inhumane. Just explain, how significant are financial considerations in this case to you anyway? I mean, we should say Barbara Howe has been in this hospital since 1999. Her care costs about $2,000 a day. Her insurer stopped paying in 2003 because of the limitations of the coverage that she had.
Yeah.
No one's saying who's paying for Barbara Howe's care right now, but a Boston Globe reporter we contacted says she thinks the hospital is picking up the tab.
Yeah.
And the hospital is definitely offering to move Barbara Howe to another facility that they say would provide more appropriate care. But there's the insinuation that the hospital's making this decision now to reject the proxy's request because it's costing them.
Yeah, I don't think that's true at all. As physicians, we are very, very careful to be patient-centered. And although there may be financial issues, those are to be discussed outside of the doctor-patient relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So the doctors are there to do whatever best for the patient, whether that be more treatment, less treatment, whatever it is. And the financial issues are to be discussed in another forum,
mm-hmm.
but not to be confused and blurred with the patient-centered patient care.
Dr. Michael Grodin is director of the Law, Medicine, and Ethics Program at Boston University Schools of Medicine and Public Health. We want to now bring in the conversation Professor Charles Barron. He teaches law at Boston College, is an expert on patient rights. Professor Barron, what a tough situation. Doctors who feel they're doing the right thing, a daughter who feels she's doing the right thing. Your thoughts?
It is a terrible situation, and as Michael says, it's a very rare one, although in some respects it's also a very new one. Most of these laws that have been passed with respect to living wills and healthcare proxies were passed at a time when doctors would take the opposite tack, when patients made very clear that they were ready to give up and the doctors insisted on forcing treatment on the patients because they thought the patient's decision was medically irrational.
Hmm.
So this is a new sort of situation, one we've seen only for maybe the past 5 or 6 years, really, where patients or proxies have been demanding treatment and doctors have been saying that it's medically futile.
And we mentioned, Dr. Grodin mentioned, that there were a handful of cases, I think about 7 or 8. How were they ruled on?
They've gone both ways. In some cases where the treatment has been demanded and they've gone to court, the court has decided that the treatment was to be continued. In some cases, because of the special facts, I think, the courts have decided that The doctors are right. It's medically futile, and treatment can be discontinued.
And Dr. Grodin, who's been listening in, there are other cases, in the country right now that we're focusing on that are somewhat like this case here in Boston. I'm thinking of the Terry Schiavo case in Florida.
I think what's important is that each case is different, and the fact patterns are very different. So you're right, in some sense, the issue is termination of discontinuation of life support. But Terry Schiavo is in a permanent vegetative state. And, of course, she had assigned her husband as the appropriate person to make decisions for her, and her husband, speaking on her behalf, says she doesn't want treatment anymore. Should be the end of the story. Very different than this situation where we have a question of whether she's doing what's in the best interest of her mother. Professor Barron's absolutely right in terms of the switch in things. I've been doing this for 26 years, and, again, it used to be that you couldn't get off a ventilator. And, in fact, the medical students can't believe that when I tell mm-hmm. them that there was a time that you couldn't refuse treatment.
Dr. Grodin or Dr. Barron, both of you weigh in. Have either of you seen these situations? Have you had to stand there in the hospital room with, you know, someone's daughter who cannot bear the thought of giving the okay to let their parent die?
I mean, I deal with this every day and consulting in the ICUs. Obviously, there are all kinds of issues that come out when somebody has a terminal illness or when someone's sick and dying. And oftentimes, I'm a psychiatrist, oftentimes all kinds of family issues that have been unresolved come to play when someone's in this crisis situation. So it's not uncommon to have all kinds of family dynamics play out. Mm. And what you need to do is have good conflict resolution skills. You need to have good group dynamic skills. Again, communication is the key, and mostly that resolves many of these problems, or at least resolves them to the point where we realize that there's uncertainty and we just have to monitor and go step by step.
Dr. Barrett, I'm wondering, too, does it bring out psychological issues with doctors as well?
Absolutely. And I have also had these experiences, typically representing patients or representing families. And I do think that even though now doctors have very generally accepted the fact that it's all right to stop treatment, there are still problems. Of course, doctors are human beings. I don't think that's shocking information. And their psychology can play a role here as well.
Well, Professor Barron, how do people avoid this? Here we have the case in Massachusetts where a daughter had herself appointed proxy, and she still has to fight to have what she feels are her mother's wishes expressed. In Florida, a husband who feels he absolutely knows what his wife wanted, but parents who see the situation completely different. So how do you avoid this?
Well, there's no way in society, there's no way in law to make absolutely sure that you're going to prevent any kind of problem. There are now either healthcare proxy statutes or living will statutes in every one of the states in the District of Columbia. There are some 36 statutes that provide for surrogate decision-making by family members.
And they're all different.
They're all different, but they follow certain models. The problem is that, as with any trial, there can be disputes with respect to facts.
Well, Professor Charles Barron, hold that thought, because when we return, we'll continue our conversation on patients' rights and end-of-life medical decisions, and we'll learn what you need to do if you're facing those decisions. We're also going to hear from a journalist who's going public with his own battle with Lou Gehrig's disease, and we'll get his thoughts on the Massachusetts case as well. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing our conversation on end-of-life medical decision-making and patients' rights with Boston College Law Professor Charles Barron and Dr. Michael Grodin, who's director of the Law, Medicine, and Ethics Program at Boston University. A conversation prompted by a case at Massachusetts General Hospital where an elderly woman with Lou Gehrig's disease has been on a ventilator for years, and her doctors disagree with her daughter, who is her healthcare proxy, about keeping her on life support. And Professor Barron, what can people do to avoid terrible situations like this? Should people hire a lawyer if someone becomes catastrophically ill?
As someone who makes his money from training lawyers or potential lawyers, I can't say don't see a lawyer. But I'll come close to what Mike's saying is I don't think that for the most part you need a lawyer in the first instance. In every state, you can probably just go online and you can get some sort of official form that's made available by the Association for the Advancement of Retired People or by some local organization that you can then fill out as a healthcare proxy or as a living will. I agree with Michael 100%. The way to go is with the durable power of attorney or with a healthcare proxy. It's much better for you to pick someone you know loves you. Sit down with that person. Explain to that person what your values are. Go over some scenarios with that person so they are sure what you would like or as sure as you can be, which not only gives you some sense of security but makes them feel the decision is not theirs, which will eliminate some uncertainty or grief they might otherwise or guilt they might feel.
And it's a potentially tough conversation. But Dr. Grodin, back just to the ethics for a second. If you run into the fights within the family or fights between the proxy and the doctor, then what do you do?
Well, again, in my experience, oftentimes these are communication problems much more than they are ethics problems in many ways. And it's a matter of trying to sit down. And the main thing I've found over my years is getting everybody together in one room, the family, the doctors, the nurses, whoever is important, clergy. Clergy can be very helpful if they've been involved with the family. Oftentimes, everybody has a different understanding of what's going on, including often even what the diagnosis is, what the prognosis is, what the treatment is. So the first thing is good ethics start with good facts. But as a rule, 99.9% of the time, the proxy is the right person because they were chosen by the patient, and they're the ones who speak in the best interest and are the ones who make the decision.
It might be interesting to add that I think if those decisions are going on, the medical profession might be interested in amending these existing healthcare proxy statute. Mm-hmm. It really does not make provision for overriding the wishes of a proxy unless you can prove that the proxy is in bad faith. Otherwise, the decision by statute is left to the proxy.
Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Michael Grodin is director of the Law, Medicine, and Ethics Program at Boston University Schools of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Charles Barron is a professor of law at Boston College. Well, we turn now to someone who's facing all of these life and death issues. Rob Borsellino is a columnist for the Des Moines Register in Iowa, and this week he wrote for the first time about being diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease. Rob, welcome.
Good morning, Robin. How you doing?
I'm fine. Well, why write about this now, Rob?
Well, it's getting out there. I should point out that, I mean, Des Moines is a relatively small community. I've got an extremely high profile. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm this guy from the Bronx who moved to Iowa and writes for the paper and all this. Mm-hmm. And people were hearing about it and talking about it and approaching me about it. And that was one big thing. The other thing is, as you can probably hear, my voice mm-hmm. is a mess. Mm. And having to explain to everybody, yeah, I'm sober. It's just that I've got, Lou Gehrig's disease. That's why I sound like this. Mm. And it was getting to the point where I just wanted to get it out there.
Yeah. Well, and you wrote in the column about many of the things we just talked about, but you write that you were in denial of some of those bigger issues.
To some extent, I still am. I can still drive. I can still go to work in the morning. So it's not like I'm at the point where I've got to deal with it 24/7 because I don't.
Well, for instance, you write, one of the questions you're ignoring is, do I want to live strapped up to some breathing machine and a voice box?
Yeah.
And that's the question that's being debated, as you know, here in Massachusetts.
Well, my visceral response to that is no. If I can't function, if I can't have a decent life, then I don't want to live. That's my visceral response. Who the hell knows, a year from now?
Well, Rob, I'm wondering, when do you think you might take some legal precautions, and what might you do to make sure you don't end up in the middle of a court battle or, maybe a fight?
I've already dealt with that. I went to see an attorney and gave my wife power to make that decision. Understanding how I feel, she'll take care of it.
do you have thoughts about, you know, how you'd feel if your wife, as healthcare proxy, if her feelings were overturned by a doctor?
Well, that would really, that's something that would really anger me, even just thinking about it.
Well, your in-laws held a prayer service at a Sikh temple in New Delhi. You've got friends checking out stem cell research in Beijing online. A lot of people pulling for you.
Well, you know what's interesting, too, that it opens your eyes to something like stem cell research. People from Iowa are going to Beijing to get help for MS and Lou Gehrig's disease and a whole bunch of other stuff.
Well, Rob Borsellino, I know you've made a decision that you now have a lot to say about this subject, and I'm looking forward to reading it. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Rob. It was good talking to you.
Rob Borsellino is a columnist for the Des Moines Register in Iowa. This week he wrote for the first time about being diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease, and we're going to be checking back with him periodically. To read Rob's column, go to our website, here-now.org. And Monday on Here and Now, did you know that girls now begin to drink on average at 13? Corin Zilkus knows that all too well. That's when she started, and she drank her way through college. The author of Smashed, Story of a Drunken Girlhood, on Monday. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A federally sponsored session on preventing suicides sparked a controversy even before it really launched because of its name. Rick Weiss has covered the story for The Washington Post, and he joins us from Washington, D.C. And, Rick, we understand the conference is being held by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. The session was originally called Preventing Suicide in Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Individuals. So what happened?
Well, that's right. That's a meeting that's going to be happening this coming Monday, actually. And the researchers were ready to roll when a couple of weeks ago they got word from one of the project officers from this federal agency, which is part of the Department of Health and Human Services, telling them that they really ought to change the name of that session.
Did they say why?
Well, the name of the session, as you mentioned, has the words gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender in it. And those were four words that they really didn't want to have in the title. They suggested that perhaps something more generic like the words sexual orientation would be more inclusive, is what they said.
And wasn't this session organized because that community that is named does have a higher incidence of suicide?
That's right. These are the people in these communities have 2 to 3 times the standard rate of suicide. It's a session that was certainly geared towards them and towards health professionals who work with gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgenders. But in fact, the researchers made the point that, of course, the word sexual orientation doesn't even cover the transgender part of this talk, since transgenders really have issues of sexual identity, not sexual orientation. But this was one of a few suggestions actually given by the agency to these folks for changes. Another suggestion was that they add a session to this meeting that looked specifically at faith-based approaches to preventing suicide.
Well, now we understand the name was changed and then changed back. And SAMHSA, this is the sponsoring federal health agency, says that this is all a non-issue that's been blown out of proportion. But I know you've talked to some who say that this is part of they see it as part of a larger effort by the Bush administration to erase gay people from society. What are they saying?
Well, there are certainly some people who think this is part of a bigger picture, and there are points of evidence out there that would back up that perspective, although one never knows whether one is over-connecting dots. But certainly in the last year or so, there have been several incidences where, for example, grant proposals that had words relating to sexual orientation in them that were funded by the National Institutes of Health found themselves suddenly under increased scrutiny because of the presence of those words in them. We know that efforts towards reducing the incidence of AIDS and sexually transmitted diseases have had been under a lot of pressure to focus on faith-based approaches and to kill some words out of their grant proposals and titles. I've heard from several scientists in different federal agencies who have been told to start avoiding words like this if they want to keep getting funded.
Hmm. Rick Weiss is staff reporter with The Washington Post. And by the way, Rick, we know that the session is going ahead, as you said, Monday. And where is that?
It's going to be out in Portland, Oregon.
Rick, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, in Alabama, a bill is working its way through the state legislature that would bar state agencies and institutions from buying books, videos, or audio tapes that sanction, recognize, foster, or promote homosexuality. If passed, that bill would likely keep classic novels like The Color Purple and plays such as Tennessee Williams' Cat on a Hot Tin Roof off library shelves because they have gay characters. Representative Gerald Allen filed the bill.
The state has no business promoting anything like this as far as the homosexual agenda or promoting anything that has anything to do with laws that we have in this state that deals with the sodomy and sexual misconduct laws.
Act One. The scene is a small old colonial house which is now being used as a dormitory in a boys' school in New England.
Well, earlier this week, students at four colleges and universities around the country gathered for a 24-hour marathon reading of works that could be banned under the proposed Atlanta bill. Allison Bookbinder organized the event. She's originally from Atlanta, Georgia, but she studies theater and American studies at Wellesley College just outside Boston, and she spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes.
Allison, let me ask you, first of all, how did you go about deciding what plays you picked to read?
We really wanted to pick plays that were important to the theatrical canon, that people read beyond the homosexual characters or didn't focus on them. So Children's Hour, for example, or Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Twelfth Night, which doesn't have homosexual characters necessarily but has homoeroticism. And then plays that really dealt with the issues, The Laramie Project, we thought was particularly good, speaking about homophobia, which is really what we feel is why the bill came forward.
What do you mean when you say you tried to pick plays that were true to the canon of the theater?
Just plays that are really important and are important because of the time they were written in. The Children's Hour, for example, was written in 1934, and Lillian Hellman felt that it didn't matter that the lie was about homosexuality. What mattered was the destructive power of the lie. And when the plays revived in 1952 after the McCarthy era, you see that that idea really gets currency, and that's what the play becomes about.
Why is it important, in your view, to make a statement in the way you're making it?
What we really wanted to show with the event was the humanity of all of these characters and the fact that these characters might be living a homosexual lifestyle, but that didn't negate any of the feelings or emotions they experienced, that they were still part of society, and they were still people just like any other people.
And what would be lost, in your view, Allison, if the proposal in Alabama succeeded, and plays like this or some books were taken off library shelves or plays couldn't be performed in student or high school theaters?
Simply, we'd be missing part of the human experience. We'd be missing getting to learn about another facet of life. That's what theater is for. It's to learn.
But Representative Allen might say that the state, meaning the theater or the local high schools or the libraries, mm-hmm. shouldn't be promoting the homosexual agenda.
These plays aren't promoting the homosexual agenda. What they're showing is a facet of life. These plays aren't proselytizing. These plays aren't trying to convince you to live this way of life. They're merely showing you it. I mean, when we say that art doesn't have the right to free speech, we really come into a very large problem, because then art can't do what it's supposed to do, which is to show us different human emotions and to give us different experiences.
I understand you might not necessarily be up on the current politics in Alabama, but are you worried that this proposal might actually pass there, and then perhaps it'll get a leg up elsewhere?
I'm very concerned about that. I'm especially concerned about that in the South. Being from Georgia, the political climate has changed a lot in the past 10 years. The climate in Georgia is really becoming very conservative, politically and intellectually. And so what I'm really afraid is if Georgia sees this, or South Carolina, or North Carolina, or any of those states, that they're going to go, hey, that's working in Alabama. We should do that here.
Allison Bookbinder is a senior at Wellesley College. She spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes. Still to come, will he rock the house? Predictions about host Chris Rock and the possible Academy Award winners. That's coming up. You're listening to Here and Now. A moment now for a personal reflection that I'm gathering strikes a universal chord. In fact, I'd hoped to talk about it with Boston Globe columnist Brian McGorry, who went through the same thing. But he called and begged off, saying, please, I'll do anything, but I can't talk about my dog. I understand. I have a 19-year-old Chihuahua and a decision to make. His name is Mo. Picture Yoda from Star Wars with wisps of long white hair, big white ears sticking straight out of the side of his little tiny head. I found him years ago in California, wandering with an only slightly bigger Benji look-alike we named Homie. They were starving and mangy. In fact, the first vet told me that L.A. law required that dogs with mange, a curable infection, be put down. So we made a break for it, crossing city lines to laid-back Santa Monica, where a very California pet doctor said, you know, if you don't take them, they're going to have abandonment issues. So here we all are, years later. And who knew that I'd be the one feeling abandoned? Having Homie and Mo is like having my own Muppets on a leash. Everyone who sees them smiles. Don't be fooled, I say. Mo is actually the Edward G. Robinson of dogs. Even now, his body failing him, he'll take on all comers, yapping as his legs slowly splay out until he's flat as a pancake. He reminds me of that character in Monty Python. It's just a flesh wound. I'm still the boss of you. But he's not. Past exploits seem to be catching up with Mo. He once ate my tube of super glue and couldn't open his mouth for days. Both Mo and Homie have had their stomachs pumped once after they ate the chocolate kisses someone pushed through the mail slot. For weeks, they deposited little gifts wrapped in colorful foil. He sings opera, I swear to you, and I've woken up wearing him as a hat during countless frightening thunderstorms. But now he wakes at night frightened by something I can't protect him from, wailing for hours on end. I'm at a loss. I have a wonderful vet standing by who makes house calls. And thankfully, I have the words of columnist Brian McGorry. I want to share an excerpt in case it's helpful to anyone else.
They should come with a warning label, these creatures. They should come with a label that says you're going to fall hopelessly in love, only to have your heart shattered before you could ever possibly prepare. And then you face one of life's truly wrenching decisions. Which is where I am now, watching a sleeping golden retriever named Harry drift another day closer to death. He's gorgeous, this dog, with a gray face that shows the wisdom gained from his 10 years on Earth and brown eyes that are the most thoughtful I've ever seen. And the question that has dominated my thoughts for weeks, how will I know when the time is right? We've fetched maybe a quarter of a million throws, walked, I would wager, over 10,000 miles together. He carried a tennis ball in his mouth for most of them, convinced that anyone who saw him would be duly impressed. And judging by their reactions, he's right. Throughout, he has shown me sunrises and sunsets that I wouldn't otherwise have seen. He has introduced me to people, kind people, whom I otherwise wouldn't have met. He's been a sanctuary, a confidant, who regards it as his personal mission to make me laugh, whether by a ritualistic dance over a pig's ear or by a gushing lick to my face. It's impossible to be in a bad mood around him. All along, he's lived by one simple mantra: count me in. His time, though, is fleeting, a fact that he's starting to understand. His lifelong veterinarian blinked back tears as she informed me that his stomach pains were caused by cancer. When rounds of chemotherapy failed, I stopped his treatments. Now he often wakes in the dark before dawn, moaning softly in pain. But by daybreak, he is urging me toward the beach or guiding me on another walk, ball in mouth, ready to fetch, albeit slowly. Maybe I should be embarrassed to admit that a dog can change a man, but I'm not. So as the clock winds out on a life well lived, I look back at the lessons learned from this calm and dignified creature, and I look into those handsome brown eyes for the sign that the time has come. He'll give it to me when he's ready. And hard as it will be, we'll both know the journey was better than we could have ever possibly hoped.
Brian McGorry wrote that column last November. He finally got his sign from Harry. I think I'm getting mine from Mo as well. To read Brian McGorry's full column, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, Sunday is the 77th Academy Awards, and some of us may need a little escape, so here's a preview. The Aviator, Martin Scorsese's biopic of the life of Howard Hughes, looked to be the frontrunner for Best Picture, with 11 nominations, but Clint Eastwood's boxing film Million Dollar Baby is a late favorite. Ray, Sideways, and Finding Neverland are the other nominees. We're looking at the odds-on favorites with Here Now's pop culture watcher and Boston Globe critic Renee Graham. Renee, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
Last year, The Lord of the Rings Return of the King steamrolled through the Oscars, but Entertainment Weekly says this Oscar race this year actually has some drama to it. So let's go through the major categories and try to find it. Let's start with Best Actor. Oh, wait a minute, so much for drama. I mean, do you think that anyone's going to beat Jamie Foxx's performance in Ray?
No, I mean, he has the momentum going in. He's won all the major awards. I don't think there's anyone who's even going to come close to beating Jamie Foxx out for Best Actor. But it's to me, it was a very tricky performance. I think he did a great impersonation of Ray Charles, but I don't know that he necessarily gave a great performance. At the same time, I don't think the Academy cares. I think that he's going to get the award.
And I was amazed that his competitors, Johnny Depp, Leonardo DiCaprio, Clint Eastwood in Million Dollar Baby, Don Cheadle in the amazing Hotel Rwanda, none of them had won before. I thought for sure Eastwood had won an acting Oscar before, but he hasn't.
No, his Oscars he received were for Unforgiven, which were for producing and for directing. But it's sort of odd to have Clint Eastwood nominated as an actor. I never thought he was a particularly good actor. I think he's a far better director. So I think it was sort of strange that he's in there, and I think Clint Eastwood got the slot that should have gone to Paul Giamatti in Sideways.
Okay, tell us more about that. You love Giamatti.
I love Paul Giamatti. I loved him last year in American Splendor. He was also snubbed for an Oscar nomination in that film. And I don't know what the Academy's got against this guy. He's a really solid, really good actor. And for some reason, the Academy just doesn't get him.
Well, it's not just one woman's opinion. There are a lot of people who feel that way, that Giamatti was left out. But also, a lot of people agree with you. Jamie Foxx is the winner. We have a clip set up this scene for us.
The clip we're going to hear is one of the better scenes because it goes beyond just imitation and really sort of gets beneath Ray Charles' skin a bit more, and it sort of deals with his business savvy and how he dealt with his record company.
Yeah, but Mr. Clark, you know, I've been at Atlantic for so long. I just wanted to give those guys a chance, you know, to at least, match the offer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, certainly, but I doubt they'll be able to. Remember, we're giving you a state-of-the-art deal here.
Well, you know, since I'm producing my own records, I was wondering if I could own my masters, too.
Let's move to Best Actress. It's been billed as a rematch between Hilary Swank, her role as an aspiring boxer in Million Dollar Baby, and Annette Bening as the aging stage diva in Being Julia. It would be fun if they would just wrestle for the Oscar.
I don't see why not, although, you know, given the way Hilary Swank was built up for Million Dollar Baby, I have a feeling she could probably take Annette Bening. That's the one of the few categories that there's some real tension, because these are two actresses who went up against each other in 2000. Annette Bening was then in American Beauty, and Hilary Swank won for Boys Don't Cry. I think Hilary Swank will win it again. The only thing I think that can stop Hilary Swank from winning is whether or not the Academy can deal with the fact that she would be a two-time Oscar winner.
Well, let's hear from them both. Hilary Swank first. Set up this scene from Million Dollar Baby.
The scene we're going to hear is Hilary Swank's boxer, who's named Maggie, talking to her trainer, Frankie, who's played by Clint Eastwood.
My brother's in prison. My sister cheats on welfare by pretending one of her babies is still alive. My daddy's dead, and my mama weighs 312 pounds. If I was thinking straight, I'd go back home, find a used trailer, buy a deep fryer and some Oreos. Problem is, this is the only thing I ever felt good doing. If I'm too old for this, then I got nothing.
Hilary Swank, the odds-on favorite to win the Best Actress Award on Sunday night. But a lot of people, as you said, are betting on betting. Let's hear a scene from Being Julia.
I'm exhausted, Dolly. I feel twice my age, which makes me 90. I'm bored. Life has nothing in store for me.
You mean that, or are you acting? I never know when you're acting.
I'm not acting. I'm near to having a breakdown. I feel as though my life has come to an end.
All right.
But do you think there's anyone who is also a contender in that category? We've got Imelda Staunton and Vera Drake, an amazing performance.
Imelda Staunton, people have talked about this film and have talked about her performance a great deal, but I just don't think she's well known enough. I just don't think enough people saw the movie, and I think that will hurt her. I would love to see Kate Winslet get it for Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. I really liked her in that movie. But again, I just think this is going to be between Annette Bening and Hilary Swank, with Hilary Swank probably taking the award.
Okay, let's move on to Best Supporting Actor. Alan Alda in The Aviator, Thomas Hayden Church nominated for Sideways, Jamie Foxx, his second nomination of the night for Collateral, Clive Owen for A Closer, and Morgan Freeman for Million Dollar Baby. Do you think this has to be Morgan Freeman's night?
This has got to be Morgan Freeman's year. The fact that Morgan Freeman doesn't already have an Oscar is one of those great travesties of the Academy. And there are people who would argue that he's done this kind of performance before, say in a film like Shawshank Redemption. But you know what? He does that performance often, and he gets it right every time. Give the award to Morgan Freeman.
Please.
Period.
Okay, and moving to Best Supporting Actress, I loved Virginia Madsen's performance, especially one monologue she delivered about wine and love in the film Sideways. What do you think?
I would give it to Virginia Madsen, but, you know, in the last few weeks, suddenly Cate Blanchett is coming up. She plays Katharine Hepburn in The Aviator.
Howard, we're not like everyone else. Too many acute angles, too many eccentricities. You have to be very careful not to let people in, or they'll make us into freaks.
Cate Blanchett in The Aviator. The other nominees, by the way, in Best Supporting Actress, Laura Linney in Kinsey. Sophie Okonedo in Hotel Rwanda. She played Don Cheadle's character's wife beautifully. And Natalie Portman in Closer. So your bet is for Cate Blanchett?
My bet's for Cate Blanchett. I wouldn't be heartbroken to see Virginia Madsen get it. And what I like about Sophie Okonedo getting the nomination is it raises her profile.
Okay, Best Picture, Best Director. They usually go hand in hand. And everybody was saying this was going to be Martin Scorsese's year, finally, another one. Like, why doesn't this man have Oscars all over his mantle? He of course, directed The Aviator, but Clint Eastwood comes from behind with Million Dollar Baby.
Here's the Scorsese thing. Martin Scorsese should not only have one Oscar, he should have several Oscars. He should have won for Raging Bull. He should have won for Goodfellas. He lost both times. I think he's going to lose again. I think he lost in the past because he made films that were considered too much outside the Hollywood system. They were too East Coast. Now I think with The Aviator, he's made a film that's too Hollywood. It doesn't even feel like a Scorsese film. It feels like the kind of film anyone could have made. It doesn't have his imprint on it, which is why I think he will lose yet again to another actor-turned-director, Clint Eastwood.
All right, well, we'll watch and see. And some other things we're going to be watching for, at least three of the films that are nominated in various categories, have controversial subjects. We're not going to say which films because we don't want to give away plots. No spoilers. But assisted suicide is mentioned in two films, and abortion is the theme in another. And there are some protesters who've said they're going to show up, so we'll watch for that. But then there's always Chris Rock.
Chris Rock is the reason to watch the show this year. The Oscars are notoriously boring, the longest 4 hours you will ever spend. Chris Rock is going to bring a lot of energy and unpredictability to the show.
Well, he has. He was famously quoted in Entertainment Weekly as saying, "What straight black man sits there and watches the Oscars?" And he called awards for art idiotic. So there you go. It's just a preview of what we might hear.
And he's right. You know, Gil Cates is a producer of this show, and he knows he's got to keep the waters flowing because it's a four-hour show. And the best way to do that is to have someone who's going to be up there who you don't know what he's going to say or what he's going to do. You know, it's not, Chris Rock won't be there just to say, you know, and now here we have Cate Blanchett. No, he's not going to do that. He's going to rip the thing apart, and I think that is going to be the reason to watch the Oscars. I think it's a brilliant move. I think it'll be fantastic.
We'll hear what you think on Monday. Yeah. Here now is pop culture critic Renee Graham, also a critic for the Boston Globe. Renee, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Unchain my heart.
Unchain my heart.
Baby, let me be.
Unchain my heart.
Unchain my heart.
Unchain my heart.
'Cause you don't care about me.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Special thanks today to George Hicks. Thank you, George. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend and join us again, Here and Now.
Set me free. Unchain my heart.
Unchain my heart.
Baby, let me go.
Unchain my heart.
Unchain my heart.
Unchain my heart.
'Cause you don't love me no more.
Unchain my heart.
Every time I call you on the phone.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.